Arguments, and the next case on the calendar is State of Minnesota versus Pierre Jarrell Anderson. Who is arguing for appellant?
Jenna Yauch Erickson for appellant, Your Honor.
Thank you. You want to either take the podium or, if you prefer, the smaller stand next to your table, and we'll hear your oral argument on behalf of appellant.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauch Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Pierre Anderson. Mr. Anderson has presented four issues for this court's consideration. This morning, I'd like to begin by discussing the first. That is, whether this court should reverse Mr. Anderson's third-degree murder conviction because, pursuant to the Minnesota Supreme Court's opinion in Neuer, this case falls into the particular person exclusion. Careful attention to the facts in this record indicate that this case does fall into the particular person exclusion because only one person, Mr. Ken Neeson, was in the path of the vehicle as it drove forward.
So at trial counsel, this wasn't argued at all. It was argued as an accident and that he didn't intend to harm anyone, let alone the person who died in this case. It seems like the case was presented completely opposite to the jury.
So there's two responses to that, Your Honor. One of which is, at the time Mr. Anderson's case was tried, Neuer hadn't been released yet. So respondent makes much of the fact that we've flip-flopped on appeal. That argument was not legally available to him at the time. At the time, this court's opinion was the precedent, which said it is a third-degree murder if you direct your conduct at a particular person. He could not have possibly argued a theory that was not legally available to him. Second, we know that a defendant, an appellant, need not preserve a sufficiency issue in district court to raise it at this court. That is in Pachnuk, among other cases. This happens all the time, frankly, that appellate counsel sees something different and raises it to this court as a sufficiency, and that doesn't need to be preserved for Your Honors to review it.
So are you saying the record shows that appellant, knowingly ran over the victim?
I don't know that I'd go that far, Your Honor, but it's true that there's only one person in his path.
But that's a little bit different than Neuer, isn't it? I mean, in Neuer, the reasoning was the shot was fired at this person. And you're not saying, well, your client drove over this person intentionally or like aimed the car at this person and drove. It seems quite different.
So the question really is one of two things. Either Mr. Anderson's conduct was generally indifferent to human life, generally reckless, or it was directed at a particular person. It's really a dichotomy. It's one of two things.
Isn't it? What time did this happen?
It was after 9 o'clock at night, roughly 9:30 in January, so it was dark.
Well, isn't it? I mean, could it be said that it was generally reckless to drive like that through a Target parking lot at night?
No, because we're only looking at his driving conduct for the very small distance before he hit Mr. Anderson. That there's no crime that happens after he passes by Mr. Anderson. There's no allegation from the state that anyone else was endangered. And we'd be talking about mere proximity then. So Neuer is also quite clear. So Mr. Neuer, in fact, shot a gun at very close proximity to his partner. And that was part of the state's argument there, was that he also endangered his partner in the squad car. The Supreme Court concluded, no, that's mere proximity, that's not enough. When you direct your conduct at a particular person, the physical proximity of others doesn't sort of negate that, doesn't turn it into recklessness.
So that's what I'm getting at. Did your client direct his driving conduct at the victim?
Yes, because that is the only person who was in his path.
No, but that goes, whether it was directed at a particular person goes somewhat to the defendant's state of mind.
So his state of mind has to be generalized recklessness, not directed at. We're looking at an eminently dangerous act that involves a high risk of death. That's the act. The mental state, we've now clarified in the state of Minnesota, is this generalized indifference to human life that we also call recklessness.
Well, except the state argues that it wasn't just Ken who was there, it was Corey and Wyatt as well.
And the state is incorrect about those people. Wyatt was on the side of the car. We know this unequivocally because
But it's January and can be icy. He was right there, right?
Well, he was to the side of the vehicle, not in its forward path. He struck it with a crowbar and believed he broke the driver's side window. It's not possible for him to have been in danger. Corey is the same, although slight.
I'm sorry, but he first put the vehicle in reverse and backed it up into a snowbank so that he could get it out past the pickup, and then he went forward. Are you saying that other people in the vicinity of that vehicle, as it was being rocked back and forth after dark with these people around there, that somehow they weren't a potential victim of his driving conduct?
They were not, Your Honor. His reversing behavior actually shows quite a bit of caution, that he didn't just either ram straight forward into this car that had blocked him in, nor did he ram straight backward into the car next to him. He instead avoided every vehicle possible.
Well, he would have not gotten very far if he had rammed into either one of those.
But that would have shown a generalized indifference to human life, whether or not he got away. If he was just willy-nilly, cases like Montermini, cases like Hall, cases like, frankly, Coleman, that involve incredibly reckless driving conduct, willy-nilly speeding, driving all over the road, lack of care for all of your fellow drivers, fall into that category. This doesn't. In fact, what Mr. Anderson is trying to do, instead of being indifferent to human life, is protect his own, because he's been ambushed by strangers with weapons. He did not know there were going to be five people, and they continue coming out of this truck at him. In fact, assaulted him by swinging a crowbar. He is acting to protect himself, not because he doesn't care about human life.
What about the text message he sent afterwards, or the Facebook message?
Well, we don't really know what that means, Your Honor. His defense at trial was certainly that he did not perceive that he hit anyone, did not perceive that he was leaving the scene, and so that can be interpreted as, you tried to get me and you didn't, right? You tried to come ambush me and get your stuff back, and...
Well, didn't the jury hear evidence, though, or see evidence of a video of this vehicle rocking up and down as the front wheels ran over him and then the back wheels also? I mean, wasn't that evidence available to the jury?
Of course, Your Honor. That is true. That doesn't change whether he was generally indifferent to human life or particularly directed at one life.
Well, if the jury concluded that he, you know, a reasonable person would have known he hit someone, and then he leaves the scene.
But those aren't elements of third-degree murder. That's not what we're contesting here.
But, I mean, doesn't it go to show that he had a reckless indifference to human life, just his actions, you know, before, during, and after?
No, I disagree. I think his conduct before and during are the most important here. What you do afterwards, he wasn't charged with any sort of crime like fleeing police or something like that, where your flight is really indicative of what's going on in your mind. Instead, beforehand, three different state witnesses said he looked scared, he looked panicked, he looked wide-eyed because he doesn't know who these people are or why they're here or why they're attacking him. Moreover, Your Honor, your point goes directly to the second issue, which is how the jury was instructed. So we know this jury was instructed erroneously. So this is a really difficult case to try and parse out what this particular jury found and what they didn't.
How should the jury have been instructed?
So the jury should have been instructed as the Coleman court directed. And so instead of saying a reckless act, it should have been an eminently dangerous act that involves a high risk of death. And the mental state element should have been defined as this generalized indifference to human life. So it's the mental state that's recklessness, not the act.
Are we sure the jury would not have reached the same conclusion on these facts with that accurate instruction?
That is our position here, Your Honor, and that is how we are proving prejudice to you, is to say if the jury had been correctly instructed, they would not have found him guilty.
So they needed to be instructed an imminently dangerous act.
Yep, yes, eminently dangerous, and the mental state is a reckless indifference to human life.
How difficult is it to conclude that something's imminently dangerous if it's, you know, January in Minnesota, bad roads, bad parking lots, Target, which is a busy place, night, you can't see as well, and he's doing these driving maneuvers? So isn't that, could the jury say, yeah, that was imminently dangerous with people standing around outside of the car?
We would say no, Your Honor, for two reasons. One of which is that he did exercise a degree of caution. He didn't just drive straight forward into this truck that blocked him in, not knowing how many people were in the truck. Perhaps that would have been a mental state of recklessness and an imminently dangerous act. Instead, he reversed carefully to avoid the VW that was next to him. He avoided contact with the truck. He avoided that tailgate. So that shows that he wasn't just, I don't care about any lives.
But then he ran over the victim.
Well, and again, that goes to sort of the first issue and what was in his mind. Yes, he did. We don't dispute that. He hit the victim and the victim died. And that's why he was charged with crimes, and that's why we're here. Nonetheless, what we're asking is this court to find, well, you'd have to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the change in jury instruction wouldn't have had a significant impact on the verdict.
Does the conduct between the time he hits the victim with the front of the car and then runs over the victim with the back end of the car, does that count?
I mean, that would be maybe a fraction of a second.
Okay, but we say a defendant can form intent to kill within a fraction of a second. Why isn't conduct within a fraction of a second enough to show engagement in an act that's imminently dangerous?
Well, and I think you'd still have to find, even if you held, that's imminently dangerous, continuing to drive. You'd still have to find that the jury would have also concluded that he had this mental state, that he was recklessly indifferent to all human life.
Devil's advocate, yeah.
The testimony was that he rolled over Ken, and Ken either rolled or was dragged under the Denali for about 50 feet, before the rear tires also drove over him.
That's true, Your Honor, and we don't dispute that.
That's more than a second.
Yeah, and isn't evidence of a reckless indifference to human life?
Well, I would say that's conduct that's particularly directed at one person. At that point, he's certainly not endangering anyone else. He's absolutely endangering Ken. But again, that's not a third-degree murder pursuant to Noor, now in the state of Minnesota. And I think the most important moment to judge a defendant's third-degree murder recklessness is before he begins that act. So the prototypical third-degree murder cases are driving into a crowd or shooting into a crowd, right? Those are really common in the case law. And if you put yourself in that person's mindset, as we sometimes need to do as courts and practitioners, those people have decided they don't care about human lives. I am going to pull this trigger. I am going to step on the accelerator, seeing all of these people in front of me. That is not what Mr. Anderson did. Again, he's acting to get away from what is to him an incredibly dangerous situation.
How do we know that? He didn't testify. We really don't know what his state of mind is, other than the look on his face that people caught in a fraction of a second. So, I mean, he could have certainly chose to present that evidence if he wanted it considered, but the jury didn't have that.
Well, so if we're talking about the sufficiency, Your Honor, we're talking about the circumstances proved and inferences you can make. And I think any jury, any common layperson can infer that when you go to conduct a sale transaction expecting one person to meet you, instead there are five, they approach you with hostile intent. As they testified, they trapped him. They blocked him in purposefully. They hid their identity. They didn't bring any money to do this transaction. They were going to get their stuff back. They brought weapons.
Well,
most people would be scared.
Didn't he know, though, that here it's a dark parking lot at 9 o'clock in January, and he's fencing stolen property? I mean, that's not your typical...
Well, we don't know that he knows it's stolen, first of all. There's no evidence of that in the record. And it was a mutual agreement as to the site. It's not as if Mr. Anderson chose it knowing that someone was going to lie in wait for him and then block his pickup into a snowbank. So certainly there is ample evidence in this record from which any jury can infer that's scary. That's scary to anyone, including Mr. Anderson.
Couldn't the jury draw the opposite inference, though, that, they knew the property had been stolen from the transmission shop, right?
They knew that it had been stolen.
Right, and somehow within a few days, Mr. Anderson is in possession of that, trying to sell it on Facebook Marketplace and sets up a transaction at night in the back of a Target parking lot. It seems to me there's a lot of inferences that this wasn't an up-and-up deal, and the jury could infer that.
Well, that doesn't go to any element in this offense, Your Honor, and I think your standard of...
It goes to your argument, though, that he's somehow panicked when he does this. And it seems to me the only evidence in the record of that was the look on his face that these witnesses testified to.
So two responses, one of which is your standard of review is important here. Even if that's one reasonable inference on these circumstances proved, it is not the only one. We don't have to disprove that inference. We have to instead only prove to you that there is another reasonable alternative. That is, that his conduct was directed at only a single person. Even if he believes this transaction is fraudulent, criminal, whatever, that doesn't mean he murdered someone. The state still had to prove every element of this offense beyond a reasonable doubt. Three state's witnesses, said that the guy looked scared. That evidence was uncontested. No, the state didn't somehow counter that with other evidence of how he might have been feeling. And again, it's quite clear the jury can infer that he felt fear. I see my time has expired. I would just ask this court to reverse Mr. Anderson's conviction and or grant the other relief requested in our brief. Thank you.
Of course, you'll have your 5 minutes on rebuttal. For the state? You may proceed. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Robert Yount, appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota as a respondent in today's matter. And may it please the court and opposing counsel. On January 15th, 2020, appellant struck and killed a man whom he had never met before with his 2007 GMC Yukon Denali. That man was Ken Neeson, and he was there to retrieve his stolen tools that had been stolen approximately 24 hours prior to that incident. Now, Ken Neeson was not alone that night. He brought his son, he brought his brother, he brought a family friend, and he brought a second family friend, Max, who stayed in the car. And video and direct testimony established that there was, in effect, a small group of people immediately surrounding appellant's Yukon Denali right before he began to pull away and to hit the gas. And video and direct testimony establishes that appellant drove through that small group of people when he and as he struck and killed Ken Neeson. And for that, the jury returned a guilty verdict of third-degree depraved mind murder, and that's really what's at issue on appeal here. As the court keyed in on opposing counsel's oral argument, the first two issues are really the substantive issues on appeal, about whether the State v. Knorr decision and the particular person exception applies, and whether State v. Coleman and the Minnesota's former pattern jury instruction and its admission here or instruction here should disrupt the jury's verdict. And on both counts, this court should reject those appeals.
Well, numerous times throughout the course of the trial, and particularly in closing argument, Mr. Yount, it was argued that on the initial element per Coleman, that it was reckless conduct, and it was argued repeatedly. And one of the issues that's looked at in determining whether that improper instruction affected this verdict is how it's argued and presented at trial. And it seems like that issue was focused on during the course of the trial. Why shouldn't that make a difference on the prejudice prong on whether or not that erroneous instruction made a difference here in terms of Mr. Anderson being convicted of third-degree murder?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I can jump now to the Coleman decision, and I want to start with your second point first about the standard of review, because I think it's important here to consider exactly what's before the court. Because in State v. Coleman, it was, in an academic sense, a different standard of review. That was plain error. Before the court today, we're here with a harmless error. But I would suggest to the court that when you're dealing with a prejudice prong, as Your Honor pointed out, it's in effect the same. It's about, when you're talking about a plain error standard, it's a question of whether there's a reasonable likelihood that it had a substantial impact on the jury verdict. When you're dealing with a harmless error standard, it's whether there's reasonable doubt it had a substantial impact on the jury verdict. And I want to pinpoint that because what that stands for is that Coleman is probative for how this court should resolve the case. And just like in Coleman, where the court weighed the evidence that a jury would have nonetheless heard had it received that proper instruction, the question for this court is, would that jury verdict stand if it had received that slightly altered jury instruction that State v. Coleman stands for? And it's the state's position that given the facts of this case, it is much more egregious than that in State v. Coleman. And so, for instance, if you just look at the factors that favor finding third-degree murder in compared to Stavey Coleman, first and foremost, the court noted that it was brightly lit. That means that a jury verdict or that a reasonable jury would have assumed the defendant knew that there were people around. The same holds true here. It is, I would suggest, would be unreasonable to conclude that appellant could not have known that there were people immediately surrounding and in front of his car. The video evidence just shows that he would have known that there were people there. The second factor in Coleman is that he was driving too fast and that no reasonable jury would have concluded that he wasn't acting recklessly. The same exact thing holds true here. Appellant suggested that he was not driving recklessly in that very small amount of time. I'd like to correct the record on that and direct the court's attention to what was transcript page 714 from Josh Hansen, where he specifically testified that he could hear the exhaust of the truck getting louder because of the engine, the gas pedal being pushed more and more. Then what happened? I heard a bang, and I saw the driver's side of the GMC Yukon pop up. That's direct testimony from one of the firsthand witnesses that he was gunning it out of there. He was not acting, I think as opposing counsel used the word, cautiously. He was trying to get out of there ASAP. So that stands for the same degree as within Coleman. Third, in Coleman, the defendant was intoxicated and that he had been previously intoxicated and that he knew the dangers that he was facing that day. That one, admittedly, is different than here, but to your Honor's questioning on opposing counsel is that he knew what he was doing when he arrived there. These tools had been stolen within the last 24 hours. He was meeting in the dark of a back part of a Target parking lot, and while the jury did not hear this piece of evidence, it was introduced in the record with Dr. Giacomoni's report, where this is not the first time that he had done something like this. So while the jury would not have heard that piece of evidence, what it shows is that this individual knew what he was doing. But the comparison doesn't end there, and this is where I think this case is distinguishable and more egregious from Coleman, is what happened after those factors, is that in State v. Coleman, the defendant stopped to aid the person, the child that he had hit. The defendant here certainly did not do that. The video evidence shows that he struck Ken Neeson for about a second. Then Ken Neeson was pulled underneath the car for about a second. That's when the first axle ran over him. And then the second axle ran over him about a second later. So over the course of between 3 and 4 seconds, that's when the entire accident happened. He did not stop at any point in that. He did not stop after he struck Ken Neeson. He did not stop after any reasonable person in that situation would have known that he had just struck a human being. Regardless of whether he was being ambushed, anyone would have known that he had just done that, and he did not stop. Instead, he sped out of the Target parking lot and went to a gas station. Second of all, the defendant in Coleman did not flee the scene, and he spoke to police voluntarily. Again, that did not happen here. What he did is when he saw squad cars find his vehicle at that Speedway gas station, he went out an emergency exit in the back and fled on foot in, I think it was below 0 degree weather for about 3/4 of a mile to flee from police officers. And to Your Honor, Judge Larkin's question, that is relevant and probative on the question of whether this is a more serious case. The jury heard that evidence. That is direct evidence of consciousness of guilt. And that is relevant and probative to the question here. And so to put a bow on that point that I'm trying to make here is that had the jury received that slightly altered jury instruction that was discussed in State v. Coleman versus the jury instruction that they received here, there is no reasonable doubt that they would have returned a different guilty verdict. And given the court's focus on the State v. Knorr decision, I do want to briefly discuss that because I do think it is a substantive issue here. And the court asked opposing counsel about it, and I think that's basically where it starts, is that this is factually distinguishable from State v. Knorr. In State v. Knorr, you had an officer firing a gun at a single person. Those three facts are relatively uncontested in State v. Knorr. In fact, the state was openly embracing the fact that he only shot at a single person. He didn't know who that person was. He didn't know that it was Ms. Ruschek, but it was at a single person because there was only one person on the other end of that eminently dangerous act of firing a gun. Compare that to what we have here. We have an individual driving a 2007 GMC Yukon Denali, a 2-ton vehicle, in January at night when he knows that there is a small crowd of people immediately surrounding his vehicle. And that's the distinction for why this does not fall within the particular person exception. There were multiple individuals that were within danger of his eminently dangerous act of gunning it out of there. And?
Supreme Court said proximity isn't that controlling factor. How do we know when he was driving out of there, he didn't see Mr. Neeson right in front of his vehicle and decide, I'm going anyway?
And that's exactly where I was headed, Your Honor. First, with regard to proximity is mere proximity is not sufficient. I would agree. There's black letter law that says that. And so, for instance, the fact that there was a person in the Volkswagen in the car next to his vehicle, Max was his name, his mere proximity to the fact that he was driving away would not have, been relevant or probative on the third-degree murder charge. But what is relevant and probative is the video surveillance that this court, I encourage, should just view frame by frame if it has not, because that removes any doubt that there were individuals immediately in front of his vehicle. And I say individuals immediately in front of his vehicle milliseconds before he hit Ken Neeson. And so that was Trial Exhibit 7 below. It's the target surveillance video. And if you look at the timestamps, at 9:34 and 11 seconds, that's the second in time when Ken, Corey, and Wyatt exit out of the Chevy after they've parked in the defendant, and they start to go around to try to approach the defendant's vehicle. 1 second later, the Yukon Denali reverses. You can see the reverse lights turn on. 1 second after that is when you see Ken and Wyatt in front of the Yukon Denali lights. So that's at 9:34 and 13 seconds. We're only about 2 seconds after they jumped out of the vehicle. And less than a second later, between 9:34 and 13 to 14 seconds, is when you can visibly see the Yukon Denali start driving towards Ken and Wyatt. So in less than 1 second after you have two people immediately in front of his vehicle that any reasonable person would have seen in front of their vehicle, he begins driving forward. That's uncontested. That's not just argument on my behalf. That's what the video shows. And then at 9:34 and 15 seconds, that's when you see the driver's side light of the Yukon Denali eclipsed, because that's where Ken is being sucked onto the vehicle. So all this happened within the matter of 2 to 4 seconds, which is very quick, very chaotic. It's maybe understandable that he might have been freaked out or anxious, as opposed to counsel argued, but it's irrelevant. What's relevant is that the video puts two or more individuals directly in front of the car at the moment that he decided to gun it out of there. And this is not even talking about the direct testimony from Corey Neeson, who was the victim's brother, and his direct testimony, as cited in respondent's brief, said that he was worried that the GMC Yukon Denali was going to hit him because he was directly in front of it. He was worried that he was going to be pinched between the two vehicles and that he actually had to jump out of the way to his left as the GMC Yukon Denali was approaching his right. And so that puts three individuals, Ken, Corey, and Wyatt, all in immediate proximity, not just mere proximity, but immediate proximity to his imminently dangerous act and reckless disregard for human life. And that's why the jury verdict should stand on appeal, is that it's sufficiently different from the Knorr case. And the second point I want to make with Knorr is it's sufficiently different from all historical application, as far as I can tell, of the particular person exception. And to that point, if this court looks at the State v. Knorr decision, specifically footnote 12, they have an exhaustive list of 13 previous cases where the Supreme Court has all considered an appeal from a denial to give a third-degree murder charge. And if this court reviews each of those 13 cases, you will not find a single fact pattern that is at all similar to this case. Each of those cases involved either a blunt force weapon being used on an individual person, a knife being used to stab a person to death, I believe there's a strangulation and a sexual assault case, again, on a particular person. And the vast overwhelming majority of them involve the use of firearms and guns. Most of them are first-degree murder, premeditated, because they're trying to get a third-degree lower, lesser-included instruction. But some of them are second-degree murder, where they show up to the incident. Maybe they didn't plan to use their firearm, but they did. But the point is that in each of those 13 jury instruction cases from Knorr and the historical application of this doctrine going back what is now almost 40 years, is you see the use of a weapon because it's particularized to a single person. There were no instances of the use of cars or vehicles in those 13 cases, and obviously State v. Knorr did not use that. And so that is a very big distinguishing feature in this case versus the historical application of the particular person exception. Now, with regard to the remaining two issues of the Dr. Giacomoni testimony and the entry of convictions on all verdicts, I do not intend to address those. I believe that those are addressed sufficiently in briefing. I do welcome any questions from the court on those, but unless the court has any questions, I would yield the rest of my time and ask that this court affirm the jury verdict on all three counts.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
You may proceed with rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start by discussing the differences between this case and Coleman. And I think the most important one is why the defendant did what he did. So in Coleman, the defendant had a full range of choices. He had no reason to go drive that snowmobile while incredibly intoxicated across a lake, but he chose to do so. He chose to do so not caring about human life. That is not what Mr. Anderson did. Instead, Mr. Anderson was escaping a situation that was dangerous to him. This is not a driving a snowmobile too fast, drunk, across a lake and killing a child case. This case is different.
So it's a self-defense claim in this case?
No, Your Honor, but Mr. Coleman wasn't in danger from anyone. He had no other reason to do what he did other than he didn't care about human life. That's the only purpose to doing what he's doing. Mr. Anderson had a different purpose. It was to get away. It was to get away from this situation. And I would say the standard, it matters here. I disagree with respondent. And you have to apply a standard here that is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Do you disagree that the video shows two other people in front of the car immediately before this happens?
I do, Your Honor. Certainly view the video. The video is helpful. The people are about the size of ants, and this takes place in a matter of seconds. So is it useful? Yes. What else is useful? The testimony. The testimony establishes the people's positions.
What does the video show about the people's positions?
It's really hard to tell, Your Honor, to be quite honest, because it's dark, because it's at the camera is far away from the incident. The picture is relatively clear, but it is very small. And we're talking about a matter of, I think we agree, a few seconds in which to judge people's positions. So what Corey testifies...
I'm just trying to figure out how your argument about, you know, he was just trying to escape. I mean, that sounds like a self-defense claim, but you're saying, well, it's not a self-defense claim.
Well, he didn't raise a self-defense claim.
Okay. And, but it goes to a state of mind. I just don't know how that fits in. And I'm just struggling to understand how it fits in to a third-degree murder charge. I mean, are you saying that a person can act with immediate disregard for human life if they're trying to escape danger? That certainly sounds like self-defense.
No, Your Honor, I would say what he was facing negates the possibility that his mental state was one of generalized indifference to human life. Say that wasn't in his brain because, and again, the expert testimony.
Why can't a person act purportedly in self-defense and yet not still have a general indifference to human life? I mean, one of the elements of self-defense is you can use only that force that is reasonable
sure.
to avoid the danger. So it would seem that a person could say, look, I was just trying to defend myself to escape.
Mm-hmm.
But if you went too far by driving through a crowd of people, I'm just giving an extreme example, well, you wouldn't have self-defense and it still might be third-degree murder. I don't know that the two are mutually exclusive is what I'm saying.
I understand. I think as a practical matter, perhaps Mr. Anderson did not raise a self-defense claim because, as we all know, self-defense basically requires you to admit that you committed all the elements of the offense. His defense was not that. His defense was, I have valid expert testimony that establishes a scientific reason that my brain did not perceive a human being or perceive that I hit someone. Of course, that was excluded. So his defense was, I didn't do this because I didn't know there was anyone there, which is different than self-defense. Self-defense, he would have had to say, yep, I did that, but I don't know, I wasn't trial counsel, but that perhaps is a reason that didn't get raised. I also disagree that there was only a slight alteration to the jury instruction language. That's just not true. Pre-Coleman, the erroneous instruction, which Coleman says rather explicitly, was basically a second-degree manslaughter instruction. That's an entirely different crime and a less serious crime. So it's a big alteration. I also want to just point out the idea that somehow Mr. Anderson knew what he was doing because of the 2018 incident is really frustrating and inappropriate. He's a person who makes his living by selling things legally, selling things lawfully. And in 2018, he was selling a vehicle and got shot during that interaction. The idea that he should have known he was going to be in danger from an ambush of five men because of that tragic past incident is just neither here nor there. Also, I would say, in terms of, again, going back to Corey's positioning, you have two people at opposite ends of this truck. You have Mr. Ken Neeson coming around the back tailgate. You have Mr. Corey Neeson who says his testimony, I was immediately outside the front passenger door. Again, the truck is blocking, is entirely perpendicular to Mr. Anderson's truck. He had to pick one way or the other. He picked left. It was physically impossible that he could have hit both of them because you can't go two ways at once. He picked one. Ken was the only one in his path. That is why this case falls into the particular person exclusion, and this court should reverse his third-degree murder conviction. I see that my time has expired. Again, we would ask you to...
I need clarification on that last point. So are you saying he knew the victim was there and yet he drove into the victim?
Again, that's not really the issue that's before this court. His mental state has to be either a reckless indifference to human life, shooting into a crowd, driving into a crowd, you know there's lots of people there, you're going to put them all at risk, or this particular person, it's a carve-out, right? Particular person exclusion. We carve out from that crime. When you're only doing something directed at one person, you shoot Justine Ruschek when she's the only person there.
But at trial, the theory was he didn't know he hit anybody. He wasn't trying to hit anybody. He didn't see the person in front of him.
Again, Your Honor, because Noor hadn't come out yet, he couldn't have possibly argued, I'm innocent because I directed my conduct at one particular person. That wasn't legally available to him at the time. In fact, surely there would have been objections from the state because that was the opposite of the law at the time. If there are no further questions, I would ask this court to reverse the third-degree murder conviction or in the alternative to grant a new trial as requested in our brief. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the hearing. The decision will be issued within 90 days as required by statute.